I would like to thank Tim Boyd and the Theosophical Society in America for inviting me to speak on this 129th National Gathering. And I understand that our subject for the overall gathering is psychology, science of the soul. I wonder how many of you know that that actually is the title of an unfinished article by H.P. Blavatsky. I did not know this until yesterday morning when I was doing some research in the library. I had two volumes of the journal Lucifer that I needed to look at that I had not been able to find online. And as I was paging through one of them from 1896, guess what popped out at me? That's the first of two synchronicities connected with this talk. The other one will come a little bit later. So, Eyes of the Soul, the Science of Seership. What I intend to talk about today is clairvoyant investigation, which is a part of what we do as theosophists, although I think it has somewhat been neglected, and I'm hoping to help people understand a little more about what that means and to normalize it to some extent. So the first thing I'd like to do in introducing this conference on psychology, science of the soul, is talk a little bit about those three words, psychology, science, and soul, to kind of set the tone for what will come in the subsequent days. So in the older books on theosophy, you'll often see a distinction between Western science and Eastern science. I don't think we can really safely use that distinction now, so what I prefer is exoteric science versus esoteric science, and I'd like to do a quick comparison of those two. So exoteric science is outwardly turned in that we are in ourselves looking out at the world. It has an objective approach in that we consider anything that we're viewing outside of ourselves as an object of study. The material realm is the focus of our investigation. We use outer senses and apparatuses such as telescopes and microscopes to help us understand what we're perceiving. These are our instruments of investigation. It tends to be experimental in nature, and the results are usually described by mathematics and statistics. So by contrast, esoteric or so-called Eastern science is more inward turned. The focus is within ourselves. There's a subjective approach in as much as we're paying attention to the contents of our own consciousness. States of consciousness and subtle realms are the focuses of our investigation. We use inner senses instead of outer senses as the instruments of investigation. And it tends to be experiential as opposed to experimental. And finally, the description is by personal testimony as opposed to mathematics and statistics. This is something, of course, that is not really tolerated by science. They call it anecdotal. But personal testimony has been important throughout the entire history of humanity in terms of investigating not only what goes on inside of ourselves, but also what goes on outside of ourselves. I view a similarity of method between esoteric and exoteric science, if you want to consider the esoteric as scientific. The first thing is there's always an inquiry of some kind. We open an inquiry in order to investigate something. In this, we set boundaries and the parameters of exploration. In experimental science, that usually means looking at the variables that we're going to investigate, setting up a hypothesis that we're going to test. In esoteric science, the boundaries are set pretty much by how developed we are in terms of our inner senses. We learn to observe under ideal conditions. That means experimental design in exoteric science. In esoteric science, that would mean developing your inner senses through meditation, for example, so that you have ideal receptivity for whatever it is that you're trying to investigate. It's very important to record and evaluate the results in experimental science. I think it's equally important to do that in terms of esoteric science, too. So whenever I have any interesting consciousness experience, I always make sure that I make a record of it. We refine our understanding based on the things that we're exploring. This is true both in exoteric and esoteric science. And at some point, we share the results when we're ready. So as I said, this is to demonstrate that both exoteric and esoteric science have some underlying similarities of method. Now, psychology is an interesting mix of esoteric and exoteric science, if you want to think about it in terms of inner and outer. It's about the relation of our inner life to our outer experience and how the outer and the inner affect each other. You could say that it's the subjective studied objectively. States of consciousness are the focus of our investigation. We use the mind as the instrument of our investigation. It's both experiential and experimental in the sense that there's usually somebody who's a test subject, that would be the experiential part, and then there is a psychologist who's designing an experiment of some kind to investigate what's going on inside this individual. And the description tends to be both by personal testimony in terms of the subject and by statistics in terms of the person who's doing the investigation. Branches of psychology, you could say there's a brain function or neurology is one of those. Mind function and mental health is yet another one. And the third one you could call meta-mind or the humanistic and transpersonal aspect of psychology. Humanistic having to do with our fulfillment as opposed to mental illness, and transpersonal having to do with the soul or other levels of being. So, soul, capital letters. The soul as investigated or talked about in psychological terms. Now, theosophy is very rich in terms that describe the soul. In a lot of the older literature, especially having to do with the writings of H.P. Blavatsky, one of our founders, you will find terms such as body, which of course is not really soul, but there's an animal soul, an astral soul, a human soul, a spiritual soul, and a divine soul. And those of you who know your seven principles will recognize that the body is, in Sanskrit terms, stula linga, which is the dense physical body, plus the astral body. The animal soul is kama prana, the desire principle, plus the principle of vitality or breath. The astral soul is kama manas, which is desire plus mind. The human soul is buddhi manas, which is the enlightenment or intuitive development principle, plus manas or mind. The spiritual soul is atma buddhi, which is highest self plus buddhi, the enlightenment principle. And then atman, the highest self, is the divine soul. Now, we could map these within the physical brain or the physical realm of science if we think of the body and stula linga as the reptilian brain, which is designed to focus primarily on the needs of the physical body. The animal soul or kama prana could be linked to the mammalian brain, which has to do with the limbic system, which is about likes and dislikes and the rudiments of emotion. Then we have the astral soul, kama manas. This could be linked with the human mind or the neocortex. And then we have some things that aren't really mapped into the brain that I think of as higher hierarchies of brain synchronization. So one of them could be higher mind, another one could be overmind, another one could be supermind. These are terms that I borrowed from the great 20th century spiritual teacher Sri Aurobindo. And I bring them up just to suggest that there may be levels of brain synchronization or brain integration that are beyond what we normally experience. And this is something that will become clearer as I talk, why I think it's important to mention this now. So from all of this, I came up with what could be called a working definition of the term soul. And in order to do this, I wanted to make sure that this term was equally mappable in religion, philosophy, science, and religion. So the hypothetical or experienced sense of a personalized guiding wholeness or presence. Hypothetical in terms of psychology or philosophy, experienced in terms of mystics or theosophists, meditators, and so on. But the idea is it's personalized, it guides us, there's a sense of wholeness about it, and we may experience it as a presence, whose function is to lead us toward a higher level of integration within ourselves and the universe. Now, this higher level of integration, it doesn't necessarily have to be a higher body or a higher principle. It could just be a higher level of brain integration, or it could be both. Whether ourselves and universe are conceived as material or spiritual, or a continuum extending from one to the other. So I put the word material in there to emphasize the scientific approach to things. The word spiritual is in there to represent the religious side of things. And the continuum extending from one to the other is the theosophical approach to things. Now let's talk about the word seership that's in the title of my talk this morning. A seer is one who sees, a prophet or clairvoyant. And this word clairvoyant is an interesting one. It comes from the French and it means clear seeing. I'll talk more about what that means in a moment. Seership is kind of an invented word. You'll see it in some theosophical literature from the 1920s and 30s. I think Jeffrey Hodson was responsible for using that word. It's the being or becoming a seer, whether by a natural gift or intentional development. The science of seership would be a scientific approach to being or becoming a seer. And the eyes of the soul would be seeing with a more integrated mind or from a higher level of being. So again, I want to map this on both sides of the question, whether it's higher levels of brain functioning or whether it's higher levels of being in terms of planes and subtle bodies, such as we learn about in theosophy. Clairvoyant investigation, as I mentioned, this is something I want to normalize. This is a picture from Leadbeater's book on the chakras. This is his image of the sixth chakra, which he perceived clairvoyantly, communicated to an artist. The artist represented it. I thought it was an appropriate image for talking about clairvoyant investigation because the sixth chakra is the brow or third eye chakra, which is supposedly responsible for such things. So here are our founders, H.P. Blavatsky and H.S. Alcott. And it's important for us to remember that they founded the Theosophical Society on the basis of clairvoyant investigation. They met each other investigating mediums. As they got to know each other, there were all kinds of interesting experiments in the early years in New York, including experiments on astral projection that you can read about in the collected letters of H.P. Blavatsky. And also, Alcott himself was very interested in mesmeric or magnetic healing and had quite a bit of experience of that in India. So again, our founders are very devoted right from the beginning to the idea of clairvoyant investigation. Now, of course, everybody, I imagine, has many times become aware and been reminded of the three objects of the Theosophical Society. This is the 1896 version, and I'm bringing it up because I have one-word summaries that I like to use for talking about each one of them, and that'll make it more convenient for me to talk about them later. So, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color, that's the first object. I call that practice, so it's all embodied in that single word. Our practice is brotherhood. To encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science is the second object. I call this one study, to encapsulate it in a single word. The third object is to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in humanity. And I call this experience as opposed to investigation, because I think as human beings, we constantly have unexplained experiences of many kinds, very simple ones from knowing who's calling on the phone before we pick the phone up or look at our caller ID, and all the way up to mystical experiences of some sense of God consciousness. So I want to emphasize that from my perspective, the three objects of the Theosophical Society involve practice, study, and experience. And now I've got a series of what I'll call mugshots of our theosophical clairvoyants. C.W. Leadbeater, very famous, of course, as a clairvoyant investigator. a list of a few of his books that I have found very relevant to my own studies: The Astral Plane, The Devachanic Plane, Man Visible and Invisible, which is his perspective on the aura, The Inner Life, and The Hidden Side of Things. The last two books, I think, are very, very good for talking about what it's like to be a clairvoyant in the world and just noticing and experiencing all of the different ways that you can perceive from an etheric body perspective or an astral body perspective, even just as you're going about your daily business. And of course, his classic, The Chakras, which I helped to edit and annotate, and which I think will probably be available for signing after the talk. And then we have Annie Besant, second international president of the Theosophical Society, who was a personal student of Madame Blavatsky. Several of her books that I find very meaningful are Man and His Bodies, which I'll be quoting from later, Thought Forms, which are about the things that we create with our thoughts and desires that have a non-physical existence but influence our thinking and our feeling, and her book on the Masters. Now, I got interested in Annie Besant a number of years ago, and when I realized that she was the author of over 600 books and pamphlets, I got curious about how it would be possible to figure out what was worthwhile to read in all of that. And I created an online bibliography of all of her works, and wherever there are links to those works anywhere on the internet, you can find them on my website, kurtleland.com, at the tab that says the Annie Besant Shrine. And then this is the book that I helped to compile, editate, and annotate. Again, I think it'll be available for signing later. Invisible Worlds, Annie Besant on Psychic and Spiritual Development. And if you notice this little thing here, forward by Helena P. Blavatsky, that is not on the official cover of the book. It was a joke that they played on me unintentionally at the publishing house. What happened was they were leaving a space there for a blurb, and it didn't actually happen that they put a blurb in there. But let me tell you, when I saw the cover, when they sent it to me, I got on the phone right away and I said, is there something you're not telling me? Because, you know, we all have questions for Madame Blavatsky. I wondered if there was someone available that this forward was coming through. I wanted their number. And then Jeffrey Hodson, who I'll be referring to again later, another clairvoyant investigator, in this case of Angels and Music. The Science of Seership is one of his early books, and as you can see, that's where I got the title for my talk. The Kingdom of the Gods, which is full of beautiful illustrations of angels that he perceived. Music Forms, which is a very interesting book about how he perceived, especially classical music, as thought forms that were illustratable in artistic form. And then a later book called Clairvoyant Investigations that has a little bit of the angels and also some of the classical music. And then Dora Van Gelder Kuntz, as you know, a biography of her has just been released. The cover's the next slide, so I'll remind you of it. Specializing as a medical clairvoyant, co-inventor of therapeutic touch, her books, The Real World of Fairies, The Chakras and the Human Energy Fields, and The Personal Aura. And here's the cover of her book, which is available for sale here as well. I just picked up a copy, and I'm fascinated as I page through it to see what her experience was. Now, this question, how may clairvoyant power be safely developed, I think is a frequently asked question in theosophical circles. And this particular answer comes from Annie Besant when she was visiting in Chicago. She did a series of lectures in 1927. And at the end of the lecture, she did a question-answer period. And she often did this, but not very many of these question-answer periods were recorded. But this one was, and I think her answer is very interesting. There is no safety in it except the constant effort to use every power you already have in the service of others. Then, if you habitually use all you have to help, more power will be gained gradually by you through the assistance of those who see that you are using well what you already have. And of course, whenever you see a those with a capital T, she's talking about the Masters. Some American Lectures from 1927 is the title of that book, no longer in print. This is something that she said late in her life, which I found very poignant. "I do not know why speaking about the Masters has become much less usual among us than it used to be. HPB always took them for granted. You could not remain with her for a few hours without her saying something about the Masters. But with very many of us, they are put away at the back of our minds to be called out on some great occasion instead of being the light of our daily lives." This comes from Theosophy Past and Future from 1930. That was her lecture at the Adyar convention of that year. Now, she speculated in this same lecture that there were two reasons that this might be true. One of them was that it might be that we were afraid of aggrandizing ourselves, and the other one was that we might be afraid of being considered superstitious. But this idea of being the light of our daily lives, I think, is important to consider, and we have Abdil's book, The Masters of Wisdom, which has quite a lot to say, I think, about allowing the Masters to be the light of our lives. So in this same lecture that I was just quoting from, Annie Besant said something about ideals that I think it's very important to consider. "Life is a complicated thing in many ways. It becomes simple as you go on if you keep a high ideal, clinging to that until you get a still higher one." Again, from Theosophy Past and Future. Now, really, this is the idea of what it means to be on the path. We set ourselves an ideal, we try to achieve it. As we achieve it, we set ourselves another ideal. One of the highest ideals is the consciousness of the Master. And you can see here also the implication that what I was talking about earlier, about higher levels of brain development or hierarchizing the brain so that it works more efficiently and you're able to integrate it into a better functioning whole, is implied by this idea of going from one ideal to the next, always progressing to a higher ideal. Now, what I'd like to do is talk about Annie Besant's idea of what the consciousness of the Masters was actually like. This quotation comes from Man and His Bodies, which is a book from 1896. And this is really the core of my talk, because the idea is, what would it be like as clairvoyant investigators honoring the third object of the Theosophical Society to make our investigation what it is like to live from or to live toward the consciousness of a Master, along the lines that Annie Besant talks about here? "The consciousness of the Master stretches itself out in any direction in which he sends it, assimilates itself with any point to which he directs it, knows anything which he wills to know, and all this in order that he may help perfectly, that there may be nothing that he cannot feel, nothing that he cannot foster, nothing that he cannot strengthen, nothing that he cannot aid in its evolution. To him, the whole world is one vast evolving whole, and his place in it is that of a helper of evolution. He is able to identify himself with any step, and at that step to give the aid that is needed," as I mentioned, from Man and His Bodies. Now, I think this is a wonderful ideal that it's important for us to keep in mind, and my thought is, why not make this an object of clairvoyant investigation? And if we do this, how would we do it? So we would open an inquiry, just as I mentioned in an earlier slide. First, we pose the question. The question comes at the end of the slide. We have to let go of black and white thinking. I think anybody who reads Theosophical history will be aware that there were lots of people who got run aground or sidetracked by the idea of whether the Masters were physical or non-physical, whether they were real or imaginary, whether they were astral or whether they lived in the Himalayas. And there's no reason why they couldn't function in all of those categories. But the problem is, our minds want to do black and white thinking, so it has to be one thing or the other thing instead of both. If we're going to do clairvoyant investigation, we need to let go of this kind of thinking. And we need to be careful about looking for proof. What I've discovered as far as proof is concerned is we always end up gathering equal amounts of evidence on both sides of the question. And this is one of the reasons why, if you are constantly keeping track of news on health and scientific experiments along those lines, you'll see that coffee is good for you, and then 3 years later it's bad for you, and then 3 years later it's good for you again. This happens again and again and again, and I think it's especially true with any element of clairvoyant investigation. It's important to let go of the idea of proof and just be open to what shows up for you. And this involves adopting what I call a provisional belief. The mind wants to know and it wants to believe something, and it is a bit absolutist about the way that it thinks about things. And if we're going to lift that and not get caught up in the idea of looking for proof, what we need to do is adopt a provisional belief. Let's see what life looks like from this perspective. If it's useful to us, we keep it. If it's not useful for us, we let go of it. Otherwise, we're caught in black and white thinking and looking for proof. And then the idea is to frame our experiments or experiences as what would happen if scenarios. And the example is, what would happen if I tried to live from or toward the more integrated brain or mind or consciousness of a master? So again, trying to bring in the idea of the physical material side of things, the more philosophical or even, and then the religious spiritual side of things, the more philosophical or scientific is what I wanted to say. Now, this is a man that we don't hear much about, Algernon Blackwood, a British theosophist. He was the co-founder of the Toronto Theosophical Society, an author of many wonderful supernatural novels and short stories. And I'm bringing him up because in 1908, he published a book called John Silence. And this exemplifies what I mean by a what would happen if scenario. He posed the question, what would happen if working in London was a high adept or initiate or master in the role of a healer of souls or a psychologist of the time? And the beautiful thing about all of his writing is that while he deals with supernatural things, anything from ghosts to thought forms to astral projection, he always writes his books in such a way that you've got both the psychological explanation and the occult explanation running side by side, and everything checks out both ways. I think this is an amazing thing to experience. Plus, he often writes about nature spirits, devas, angels, things that we theosophists are very interested in, and he has an uncanny knack of bringing you into a state of consciousness that actually supports an understanding of what this means to experience something like a deva. And he's got a very funny passage in one of his later books called The Bright Messenger, where he visits a Theosophical Society meeting somewhere in England where everybody has to have a power or ability before they're allowed in. So he was very aware of the social dynamic around these things. So what would be our method of investigation if we were to take this idea of living toward or from the consciousness of a master? I believe it would be choosing a personal, local, or global challenge to investigate, and then we engage ourselves with practice, which is the first object. We approach it as a problem of applied brotherhood. Then we involve ourselves with study, the second object. We consult historical, cultural, religious, philosophical, and scientific sources for ideas. And then we involve ourselves with experience, the third object. And that might mean meditating on higher perspectives or guidance. That could include universal compassion or the idea of the consciousness of the masters that Annie Besant was talking about earlier. So what I'm suggesting here is that encoded in the three objects of the Theosophical Society is a kind of spiritual practice and an implied method of problem solving that involves practice, study, and experience. I learned this from reading dozens and dozens of Annie Besant's lectures. She constantly builds her lectures on this set of principles. So if you read them carefully, you'll see brotherhood is the thing that she starts out with as she's dealing with a problem of education or a problem of politics in India. And then she goes on to talk about the historic basis of the problem. And then she'll talk about the experiential aspect, what she's learned from her own inner guidance and study, or what theosophical teachings provide on that subject. Now, to go a little bit deeper into the idea of practice, here are some ideas of what we might be able to pursue. How might brotherhood be enhanced by meeting this particular challenge? Learning compassion and empathy, for example, developing a form of nonviolent communication, cooperation with any physical beings who might be involved, cooperation with any non-physical beings who might be involved, working for the greater good of all to develop what is called unity consciousness, one translation of the idea of buddhi. And of course, all of that is brotherhood. Under study, what teachings are available about this challenge to help us identify different aspects, steps, lessons, or solutions? We might look to the Mahatma letters. We might study the writings of Madame Blavatsky, William Quan Judge, Annie Besant, Charles W. Leadbeater. We might look to the world scriptures. We might investigate illuminated science like the Gaia hypothesis or Rupert Sheldrake's morphic fields. We might look at philosophies of ancient and modern seekers and teachers. And especially, we need to look at conflicting viewpoints. This is something that Annie Besant constantly emphasized. She was a wonderful debater, and whenever she was entering into any kind of public dialogue, she always made sure that she studied the opposite viewpoint so that she would know exactly how to key her argument. I think it's too often true of people with spiritual beliefs that they don't want to hear about the material idea of things. And again, one of the ways that I'm trying to talk about clairvoyant investigation and the three objects of the Theosophical Society is to point out that we can actually look at the brain material side, look at the scientific side, look at the religious mystical side, look at the clairvoyant metaphysical side, and they all can resonate with each other. And then on the experiential side, the third object, how might this challenge be met with experiential knowledge derived from higher states, realms, bodies, and beings? That might involve meditation, looking into dreams, astral projection, access to inner teachers, and the perspective of the master. Now, there was a publishing fad in the 1990s along these lines, books like What Would Jesus Do at Work? Or What Would the Buddha Do on a Date? And umpteen iterations of this. It's kind of trivial when you think about it in those terms, and yet the principle behind it is really useful. If you sit down and say to yourself, what would it be like for me to take what Annie Besant said about the consciousness of the masters and use that as a way of thinking about the problem that I'm investigating? So, for example, she talked about how the master reaches out and finds whatever he needs using his will. Well, we've got the internet and Google search. We can do that too in our own way, even though it's a mechanical way. And the point is, if we're investigating a problem, why not do that as a way of experiencing and learning how to deal with a problem? And it's practice. One thing that I constantly find when I'm researching a book is search terms will just pop into my mind, and I'll find exactly the thing that I need, that I'm looking for. There's some intuitive mechanism working to help me use the internet for my own benefit as I am trying to write and put across, especially abstruse theosophical ideas and obscure literature. So here's the second of the two synchronicities that I mentioned. I want to bring up a few things that our third international president, George Sidney Arendale, had happened to say. And as Tim was mentioning, later today at 4:30, there'll be a ceremony depositing his ashes in the Gardens of Remembrance. He was someone who actively spoke about his own astral projection experiences in a couple of books, The Night Bell, From Visible to Invisible Helping, and Adventures in Theosophy. The night bell is what you ring when you need your servant to come get you in the bedroom and help, you know, get a drink of water or anything like this. What he meant by this was, if he was sleeping at night and somebody somewhere in the world needed his support, he felt like it was the night bell ringing, and then he would go there as an invisible helper in an astral projection experience and provide support. So I'm calling this Invitation to Share. He has a wonderful very clearly stated and very humble and authentic way of looking at how to share this kind of inner experience that is involved with the third object. I cannot help wishing that every member of the Theosophical Society would make up his or her mind that he or she will know for himself or herself, independently of books and persons, something about something. It does not matter how small that something is, so long as he or she knows something about it. Just a little about just a little. Let him or her know it so he or she can stand on a platform and say, "This is my own experience." Whether it is at all true is another matter, but such as it is, there it is, and I bear witness to it so far as I am concerned. Isn't that a beautiful model of how to share spiritual experiences, or really any kind of experience? That comes from Adventures in Theosophy. Now, I want to do a little bit about what he just talked about here, a little sharing of personal experience. This is a painting of a nature spirit, a tree spirit, that's in Jeffrey Hodson's book, Kingdom of the Gods. I found this book sometime around 2005, 2006, but the experience I'm about to share happened 15 years earlier, and I really didn't know quite what to call it. But I'm using this as an example of what I personally mean by clairvoyant investigation. So it's not something where I sit down and I scrunch my eyes together and I try to force some kind of development. It just happens. It just shows up sometimes under special conditions. So in this case, in the area where I live in Boston, there's a beautiful pond with about a mile and a half walk around it called Jamaica Pond. I was walking around this pond in the springtime, and there's a beautiful old beech tree that has roots that extend underneath it like a waterfall that's probably 90, maybe 100 years old. And as I was walking, I was thinking about how beautiful it was that the tree was just coming into leaf and how its roots must have extended very wide underneath it and how the substance of the water was being drawn up through the tree and how the leaves were reaching out to the sun and expressing a kind of joy in doing that, a little like hands or a little like eyes even maybe. And all of a sudden, as I was doing all of this, I suddenly saw in the center of the tree a great green-gold flame that extended from the bottom of the tree to the top that had a kind of feminine presence of a head at the very top. It was a tree spirit. Well, you hear about tree spirits. You don't hear too many times of people talking about seeing them, but that is what I saw, and this is what I came across 15 years later. So I'm using this as an example because as I talk a little bit about how we can develop clairvoyant investigation for ourselves, the idea is pay attention, obviously, but also be open to the fact that explanations may come for your experience much later than you have it. So what, is it actually involved in the science of seership? On the experiential side, participate willingly, observe deeply, record as much as you can. I think it's especially important to emphasize the idea of keeping a journal of some kind, a dream journal or a record of special mystical kinds of experiences. I have typed up all of my experiences. I started keeping records when I was in high school. I started typing them up with numbers about 30 years ago, and I've got 600 or so of them, just because they show up, and I write them down when they show up, and I think people would recognize that they have many more of these experiences if they wrote them down, because the thing is, you never remember it or think about it unless somebody asks, and whoever asks, you know? One of the things that I'm trying to do in the work as I move from the different groups in my capacity as national speaker is to encourage people to share the inner life, because this is a very strong way of building community, and it helps people come back and feel like their hearts and not just their minds are being nurtured. But of course, You have to know what you experienced in terms of having written it down so that you can remember it, so that you can share it. So as I mentioned, that's the experiential third object side. The second thing is, notice the links to previous experiences. Study the experiences of others. What I mean by the first one is to your own previous experiences. Study experiences of others, past and present, looking for similarities, such as when I found Hodson's Kingdom of the Gods. Compare and interpret lightly. I actually took this from Arendelle. He's got some wonderful instructions along these lines. The thing is, most of us who are involved in reading about theosophy and get excited about things like masters and initiations may have the experience of light going off in your head in the course of meditation. And of course, you're now an initiate, right? You know, I get questions like this from time to time, and I hear stories about this. The important thing is to compare and interpret lightly. And that means a lifelong process of investigating, being open to experience, not immediately plugging it into a meaning, and especially not the highest possible meaning you can plug it into. Modify your understanding on the basis of later experiences and fuller knowledge. So in other words, after your light experience correlates with the fifth initiation, be willing to realize it probably wasn't even the first. And this is the study, second object. And then share only when ready, humbly, authentically, with no desire to impress, without concern for spiritual status, as a contribution to common knowledge. And I call this practice in the first object because this is essentially selfless sharing. It's a form of brotherhood. And anytime you get involved in spiritual groups where there is no respect for this idea of sharing humbly, authentically, and there's a lot of focus on spiritual status, you can definitely see the selfishness that's involved there and the fact that it's not brotherly because it's intended to put people down. So if we investigate along these lines, looking into the idea of the consciousness of the master in the ways that I've been suggesting, what might happen for us? We might start experiencing the opening of the eyes of the soul. And in the theosophical tradition, there's a quality of vision that goes along with each of our subtle bodies. Etheric vision allows us to perceive nature spirits and lower angels or devas. Astral vision may allow us to perceive souls of the departed. Mental vision might allow us to perceive thought forms, what I call angels of creative inspiration. Sometimes they're called inspiration devas. Causal vision might involve perceiving past lives or the presence of inner teachers. Buddhic vision allows us to perceive all life as one, which is a very high quality mystical experience. And then there's the nirvanic vision, that of the masters, which Annie Besant was describing earlier. So to conclude, I have some words from Leadbeater, come from his book on clairvoyance, about occultism practiced in, I think, a very sensible way. It would be well for students to bear in mind that occultism is the apotheosis of common sense. Now, of course, that goes against everything any scientist would say. But the word apotheosis is very well chosen here. It means not only the highest level of, which is normally what we think of in terms of that word, but the Greek root of the word is being carried up to God. And so we have implied in that word the idea of going through the ladder of planes and bodies. So the idea of occultism as the apotheosis of common sense is, as we grow, as the eyes of the soul develop for us, as we move from one body to another, we keep our common sense. It is better by far to err on the side of healthy skepticism than of overcredulity. And it is an admirable rule never to hunt about for an occult explanation when a plain and obvious physical one is available. Our duty is to endeavor to keep our balance always and never to lose our self-control. Of course, you know, here we have the people running around claiming to be in touch with ascended masters and trying to impress everybody with that. Not, of course, the theosophical masters. But to take a reasonable, common sense view of whatever may happen to us, so shall we be better theosophists, wiser occultists, and more useful helpers than we have ever been. And as I mentioned, this is from Clairvoyance, a book from 1899. And here we have Leadbeater's Aura of the Master from Man Visible and Invisible. And I particularly wanted to bring this out because I believe that if we think about living toward or from the consciousness of the Master, we might actually have the experience of being drawn in somehow to the aura of the Master and supported in some ways. And as Annie Besant said, that's the only real safe way of clairvoyant development. Use all your powers in service, and as you're able to be more of service, for example, moving from service on the physical plane to service on the astral plane, helping dreamers who need some support because of great unhappiness or illness in their life, or the departed who might be confused in some way about where they're going, what they're doing. Here is the aura of the Master as an inspiration. So that is my talk. Thank you very much for your attention.
Could there be other masters that you would get this information from?
I think there are probably many inner teachers, and they have names or they don't have names. I think there are many people who claim name brand entities, such as the ones that we have in the Theosophical Society. I'm always personally suspicious of that kind of thing. I think if there is a valid inner teacher, that teacher will probably come up with a name or no name, you know, just to keep themselves clean of all of the spiritual status issues.
If you were just generally seeking an answer without any master, your answer would come, is that valid?
That would be a method of clairvoyant investigation. The idea is to see whether the thing that you've experienced actually works out for you, whether it helps or whether it's irrelevant or something that isn't useful. This is the way we lead our lives. Any kind of intuitive prompting that comes to us has to be investigated as something useful or not useful. This is the common sense approach, I believe, to occultism. Another question?
Is there any less validity in jump-starting a clairvoyant experience, for example, with hemisync, than it is for us to develop our own capacity?
Okay, so hemisync is a sound technology invented by Robert Monroe, who is the head of the Monroe Institute, and it was developed to help the two sides of the brain synchronize under the idea that when that happens, you can experience interesting altered states of consciousness and possibly out-of-body experiences, which was something that he was very adept in. So the thing is, I would say it's not necessarily jump-starting. It depends on your expectations. But it is valid to investigate whether a tool like this works, just as it's valid to investigate whether meditation works. But if you go and you're enormously disappointed because nothing happens, then obviously in those circumstances, your investigation says, this is not a way for me. If something happens and you want to go deeper, then it is a way for you. As far as whatever experiences show up, those also need to be an object of investigation. And it's often important to recognize that whatever you experience, you may not find the answer for many years, just as it took me 15 years to find that illustration of the nature spirit in Hodson.
I think I read Annie Besant saying that the reason why she and Leadbeater and some other people thought about all this is because in the years to come, more and more people were going to be born with a psychic tendency. So to guide the development of psychism in those who are born in that way, in the, let's say, right direction or in a healthy direction. And I think that's one of the problems, because people not always have a serious and good foundation. It begins to prey on the ego and the lack of maturity and imagination, and then some people get caught up in an illusion. So I think many things you said were very useful about being humble, being common sense, being a little skeptical, because it brings a challenge. What do you think about that? And service, of course, yeah.
Well, my own story of my involvement with Theosophy is I've been reading it and studying it for about 10 years. I started having out-of-body experiences when I was a teenager, and I didn't know what they were, and they frightened me. It took me some years before someone in college handed me Robert Monroe's book and demonstrated that this was something that I could pursue and explore and develop some safety in. But what I have found in reading the Theosophical literature is there is a system that talks about just about any conceivable form of consciousness experience in an intelligent, organized way, and that there's a vast repository of truly amazing information that can support anybody who's naturally having these experiences and maybe a little afraid of them to feel safer. It does not, of course, encourage people who are wanting to have these experiences for wrong reasons, such as, you know, power and self-aggrandizement and so on. They'll have their experience, whatever it is, and as H.P. Blavatsky said, the wrecks, the shipwrecks that are strewn along the way of the path of occultism are numerous. You know, but the thing is, and again, in all the teaching that I do, both inside and outside of the Theosophical Society, I'm always trying to direct people towards the idea of safety. And service really is the key, because if you're serving, you're not selfish, you're not self-aggrandizing, and that seems to open up intuitive abilities about how to serve more. As far as many people in the New Age who are making claims for extraordinary abilities or levels of intuitive awareness or initiations, in a way I feel sorry for them, but not in the way that you might expect, not from the perspective of, you know, feeling that I know better than they do. But any extraordinary claim to abilities is going to be noticed by the same powers that Annie Besant calls they. They'll say, well, okay, let's see. And then some problem will develop for you that will test you, and either you can do it or you can't. And that's the reason why there are all these shipwrecks on the path of occultism, is because people make these claims, they draw on experiences that they actually can't handle, and then there's some problem, emotional, mental, spiritual.
Well, my question is, which of your books should I read first?
Well, not many of them are in print right now. So there's the one I'm signing, which, you know, has to do with the safety, but there's another one called The Multidimensional Human, which has been out of print and has just come back into print and is only for sale on Amazon, and there are a few copies in the bookstore that I brought with me. It is a book about what for me has been the most amazing thing about studying Theosophy, that it confirmed about 25 years of experience that I had before I started, and then it helped me understand where I might go and how things might develop from that point, where there was no other literature that made any sense to me. So the book, The Multidimensional Human, tries to bring together my personal experience and the Theosophical teachings and the idea of safety. So thank you very much for your attention.